General China greeted Sean.
I see your preparations are complete, Colonel Courtney.
Yes, they are ready, General.
Will you please go over the plans again for my benefit?
Sean singled out Sergeant Alfonso.
Describe the raid for us again, he ordered.
And General China stood in front of the mock-up lager with a swagger stick clasped behind his back and watched with quick, bright eyes, interrupting sharply to ask his questions.
Why are you using only half the available missiles?
The raiding column has to get through the Frelimo lines undetected. The missiles are bulky and heavy. A large number would be superfluous and make discovery by Frelimo much more likely. China nodded, and Sean went on. You also have to take into account the possible failure of the raid. If that happens, you have bet all your stingers on one throw of the dice. Sean shrugged.
Yes, of course. It's wise to keep half of the missiles in reserve. Even if the raid fails, we will not be left entirely helpless. Carry on.
Alfonso went through the plan step by step, illustrating with the coloured pebbles how the missile teams would move into position and lie in readiness 500 metres from the perimeter of the gunship lager, two teams confronting each sandbagged emplacement. At the signal of a red flare, the assault team would attack in full force from the south, hitting any fuel tankers that might be on the rails spur with RPG-7 rocket fire, sweeping the interior of the lager with mortar fire, and then launching a frontal assault on the southern perimeter.
The Henshaw will take fright as soon as the shooting begins, Alfonso explained. They will try to escape by flying away, but there will be a moment when they rise from the earth that they will still be low down, standing still in the air, the way a falcon hovers before it stoops. That is the moment we will kill them.
Sean and China discussed every aspect of the plan, until at last China was satisfied.
So, when will you move out?
You keep saying you, Sean pulled him up. I'm not having anything more to do with it. Sergeant Alfonso will lead the attack.
They'll move out this evening, 2 hours before dark, to penetrate the Frelimo lines during the night, lay up in cover tomorrow, and launch the attack tomorrow night.
Very well, China agreed.
I'll address the men now.
He was a compelling orator. Sean admitted as he listened to China, reminding them of the consequences of a Frelimo victory and exhorting them to deeds of valour and self-sacrifice. By the time he ceased speaking, their faces were shining and their eyes sparkled with patriotic fervour. General China raised his voice.
You are warriors. So, let me hear you sing the Renamo battle anthem.
The forest echoed and rang to the haunting beauty of their massed voices, and Sean found his vision dissolving into a blur as his eyes filled with emotion. He had not realized how much these men had come to mean to him until now that he was about to leave them.
Colonel, I would like to speak to you in private. General China broke into his sentimental reverie. Please come with me.
With a word to Claudia and Job, Sean excused himself. Give them each one more run with the simulator. He fell in beside General China, and as they set out for the headquarters bunker, Sean took no notice of the fact that China's bodyguard did not accompany them, but remained at the entrance of the amphitheatre in an arrogant manner. When they reached the command bunker, General China led them through to his underground office. There was tea ready for them, and Sean piled brown sugar into his mug and savoured the first steaming mouthful.
"So, what did you want to tell me?" he asked.
China was standing with his back to him, studying the wall map on which he had marked the developing Frelimo offensive with coloured pins. He did not answer Sean's question, and Sean would not pander to him by asking again. He sipped at the tea and waited. A signaller came through from the radio room and handed China a message flimsy. As he read it, the general exclaimed with disgust, tinged with anxiety, and reached up to move a group of coloured pins on the map. Frelimo had broken through in the west and were closing in remorselessly.
We are not containing them, China told Sean without looking around. Another messenger ducked into the bunker. He was one of China's personal bodyguards, wearing the distinctive maroon beret. He whispered something to China, and Sean thought he heard the word American. It quickened his interest. China smiled briefly and dismissed the man with a nod before he turned to Sean.
It won't work, he said.
What won't work?
The attack, as you have planned it.
Nothing is certain in wars, you should know, General, but I disagree. The plan has about a 60% chance of total success. That's pretty good odds.
The odds would be considerably higher, perhaps 80%, if you led the attack, Colonel Courtney.
I'm flattered by your estimate. However, it's hypothetical. I'm not leading it. I'm going home.
No, Colonel. You are leading the attack.
We had a bargain.
Bargain?
China smiled.
Don't be naive. I make bargains and break them as the need arises. The need has arisen, I'm afraid.
Sean sprang to his feet, his face pale as candle wax beneath the deep tan. I'm going, he said. Despite his fury, he managed to keep his voice thin and tight. I'm taking my people, and I'm leaving now, right away. You have to kill me to stop me. China touched his deaf ear and smiled again.
That notion is not without its attractions, I assure you, Colonel. However, I don't think it will come to that.
We'll see. Sean kicked back the stool on which he had been sitting, and it hit the wall and crashed over on its side. He turned and ducked out of the low doorway.
You'll be back,
China assured him softly. But Sean gave no sign of having heard him. He came out in the sunlight and strode down towards the river. He had reached the amphitheatre before he realized that something was desperately amiss. The Shangani sat rigid in their places upon the slope. They seemed not to have moved since he had last seen them. Alfonso's features were graven in black ironstone, expressionless and dull. The shield of deliberate stupidity behind which the African distances himself from powers and forces against which he has no other defence. Job was sprawled across the table in the centre of the amphitheatre. His tunic was floury with dust, and his cap still lay in the dirt at his feet. He shook his head in a dazed, uncertain fashion, and droplets of blood dripped from his nose.
What happened?
Sean ran to him, and Job stared at him, trying to focus his eyes. He had been brutally beaten. His lips were swollen into purple bruises, his mouth full of blood that stained his teeth like red wine. One eyebrow was cut through, a deep, jagged split from which blood trickled down the side of his nose. Blood welled out of both nostrils, swelling into bright pink bubbles as he breathed through it. There were lumps on his forehead, like overripe grapes, and the lobe of one ear was torn. Blood dripped into the front of his dusty tunic.
Job, what the hell?
Sean caught him by the shoulder.
Who?
I tried to stop them, Job blurted out, his eyes fixed on Sean's face. I tried.
Take it easy. Sean tried to lead him to a seat, but he shook Sean's hands away and said,
Claudia.
A flash frost of dread chilled Sean's belly.
Claudia?
He repeated and looked around him wildly. Where is she, Job? What's happened?
They took her, Job repeated. China's goons. I tried to stop them.
Sean reached for the pistol on his webbing belt. Where is she, Job? The pistol grip filled his hand.
I don't know.
Job wiped the palm of his hand down his face and looked at the blood.
I was out cold. I don't know for how long. China, you turd-munching bastard, you're going to die.
Sean whirled, ready to go charging back to the headquarters bunker.
Sean, think first,
Job called urgently. And Sean checked. So often, Job had saved him with those two words. Think first. It required an enormous effort of will.
but for seconds Sean managed to keep his head above the wave of his killing rage.
"The manuals, Job," he gritted out. "Burn them."
Job blinked at him through the blood that spilled from the split eyebrow. "Burn the manuals," Sean repeated. "Insurance man, we are the only ones who know." Job's expression cleared.
"And the cassettes," he exclaimed.
"Right," Sean said.
"The cassettes, give them to me."
While Job hastily repacked the attack cassettes into their carrying case, Sean walked across to where Alfonso sat at the front of the amphitheatre and unhooked a phosphorus grenade from his belt. Working swiftly, he used his pistol lanyard and the phosphorus grenade to rig a makeshift self-destruction device in the interior of the case of attack cassettes. He hooked the clip of his pistol lanyard through the pin of the grenade and laid the grenade itself in the middle of the case. Using the point of a bayonet, he drilled a hole through the lid of the carrying case and threaded the end of the lanyard through it. When he locked the case, he looped the free end of the lanyard securely around his own wrist.
"Let China try and get them away from me now," he said grimly.
If the case were jerked out of his grip, or if he let it fall, the lanyard would pull the pin of the grenade, destroying not only the contents, but anybody standing nearby. He waited just long enough to watch Job set a match to the pile of instruction manuals. Once they were fully ablaze, he ordered Job,
"Stay here. Make certain they're burnt to ashes."
Then, lugging the case of cassettes, he started back to the headquarters bunker.
"I said that you would be back," China greeted him with that icy, sardonic smile,
which faded swiftly as he saw the case that Sean carried and the lanyard looped around his wrist. Sean lifted the case in front of him and flaunted it in China's face.
"There is the Hand Squadron, China," he said with an effort, keeping his voice level. "Without this, your stingers are useless to you."
China's eyes flickered towards the entrance of the dugout.
"Don't even think about it," Sean warned him. "There is a grenade inside the case, a phosphorus grenade.
This lanyard is attached to the firing pin. If I drop it, like if I was to die suddenly, or someone were to pull it out of my hand, the whole lot goes up in a nice little bonfire. Happy 5th of November." They stared at each other across the desk.
"So this is a pretty little stalemate, Colonel."
China's smile was reborn, even colder and more deadly than Sean had seen it before.
"Where is Claudia Montero?" Sean asked,
and China raised his voice, summoning an orderly from the radio room.
"Bring the woman," he ordered.
And they waited, both of them poised and alert, watching each other's eyes.
"I should have thought of the cassettes," China said in conversational tones.
"That was good, Colonel, very good. You can see why I want you to lead the attack."
"While we are on the subject," Sean replied, "I have also burned the instruction manuals. There are only three of us, Job, Claudia and me, who understand the stingers."
"What about the Shanganis, Alfonso, Ferdinand?" China challenged, and Sean grinned at him like a death's head. "Not on China. They know how to shoot it, but they don't have any idea how to program the microprocessors. You need us, China. Without us, the Hinds are coming after you, and there's not a damn thing you can do about it. So don't fool with me. I have your survival in my hands."
There was a scuffle in the outer room, and both of them looked to the entrance as Claudia was pushed through the radio room. Her hands were once more manacled behind her back. She had lost her cap and her hair tumbled into her face and down her neck.
"Sean,"
she blurted when she saw him, and she pulled against the hands of the two bodyguards who held her, trying to reach him. They jerked her back and threw her against the side wall of the dugout.
"Tell your baboons to knock that off," Sean snarled,
and when they glowered at him, China restrained them with a sharp order.
"Put that woman in the chair,"